Good afternoon, and welcome. This is not a court function, but I'm very pleased to have us all gather together to help preserve the memory and the legacy of our wonderful colleague, Richard S. Arnold. To that end, one of his former law clerks, Polly Price, professor of law at Emory Law School, has now written a biography. She clerked for Judge Arnold from 1989 to 1991, which means she overlapped me by about 6 months. But I am here simply to introduce the Master of Ceremonies. This is a function of the Association of the Bar of the Eighth Circuit. But wouldn't you know, the president of that association, being an active Kansas City lawyer, is stuck in court this afternoon. In Kansas City and unavoidably couldn't come. It's a TRO, so it really is something that he could not anticipate. But one of the members of the board of the association is our own law clerk, Michael Gans, and so I'm going to turn this over to the association through our wonderful clerk, Michael.
Well, I'm happy to stand in for Barry today, and I did break out the bow tie just in honor of Judge Arnold, so you may never see me in a bow tie again. So relish the opportunity. Thank you, Chief Judge Loken, for introducing me. On behalf of the board and the membership of the Association of the Bar of the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit, I want to welcome you to this special lecture by Professor Polly Price. A few words about Professor Price, who I consider to be a member of the family even after all these years. Professor Price is presently a professor of law at the Emory University School of Law, where she also serves as the Associate Dean of Faculty, and she's also an associated faculty member of Emory's Department of History. Professor Price attended Emory University for her undergraduate degree. While a student at Emory, she was a Bobby Jones Scholar, a member of Phi Beta Kappa, and my favorite, point guard for the women's basketball team. She is an honors graduate of Harvard Law School. After graduating from Harvard Law, she clerked for Chief Judge Richard Arnold and then entered the private practice of law with the firm of King & Spalding in Atlanta and Washington, D.C. She was with the firm for several years before joining the Emory Law faculty in 1995. She has authored two books as well as numerous articles. Her most recent book, and the focus of our attendance here today, is her new book, Judge Richard S. Arnold, A Legacy of Justice on the Federal Bench. That book is not only a tribute to a great judge, a mentor of the professor, but also an insight into the workings of the federal courts of appeals. As one critic discussing the book lauded the book, members of the trial bar who seek greater understanding of how appellate court decisions are made would do well to read Professor Price's revelations. Polly, Professor Price, I want to thank you for agreeing to be here with us today. Professor Polly Price.
Thank you, Michael. I'm delighted to see all of you here. Whenever I'm introduced as a former college basketball player, I always have a little bit of trepidation because most times I'm expected to be taller than I am. But I'll note that when I played college basketball, you have to remember it was a long time ago and not far away from the years when high school girls in Arkansas and in Iowa still played half-court basketball. And as I wrote about in the book, Richard Arnold as a federal district judge had something to do with changing that. I wanted to recognize some special guests who are here. These include Kay Kelly Arnold, the wife of Richard Shepherd Arnold, the Honorable Morris S. Arnold, of course, his brother. Brenda King and Becky Fitzhugh are here. They were loyal staff members for many, many years. There is also Prior Gregory Mormon, who is representing St. Louis Abbey, a place that was very special to Richard Arnold in his lifetime. There are also several former law clerks here of Richard Arnold. I appreciate the opportunity to see all of you again, and I won't go through the names, but there are a number of them who are here. And I especially want to thank the Eighth Circuit Bar Association for hosting this event. It was 5 years ago this week that Richard Shepherd Arnold left us too soon. He died in Rochester, Minnesota on September 23rd, 2004, at the age of 68. I thought that I would begin by relating a story from the summer of 2004, and this is before his final illness. I think it's important to note for the record that it was not Judge Arnold's idea for this biography to be written. And to be honest with you, I don't know what he would think about this particular biography. And the reason I mention that is there is, within the last year, a biography has been published about John Minor Wisdom. It's a very fine book of that particular judge. It was, compared to the one that we're talking about today with respect to Judge Arnold, Judge Wisdom's biography was commissioned by Judge Wisdom. And he selected the author. He supervised the work pretty closely. And just in terms of points of comparison, as you know, many of you here, of course, know Judge Arnold far better than I did and for far longer than I did. That would not be Judge Arnold's style. Judge Arnold was reluctant about becoming the subject of a book. And again, I don't know what he would think of the final result, but he did readily agree to give me access to his judicial papers for the project. And I still remember the conversation in his chambers in Little Rock when I asked him whether I might be able to undertake the project and would there be some of his records that I could have access to. And I remember he slowly swept his arm back towards his office and he said, "Anything you need. Anything you would like to see." But then he said this. He said, "I only have one request. Don't say anything bad about another judge." And he said, then he went on to say, "I don't think you'll find anything like that because I tried to be careful." And he was absolutely right. There was a, I did not find anything like that. But that was his request to me. I think he also... He certainly recognized, as do I, that there are any number of other judges on the Eighth Circuit equally worthy of a book about their judicial careers. As just one example, I have often said that the better book would have probably been about both Morris and Richard Shepherd Arnold. It was my good fortune to have served as one of Richard Arnold's clerks, and I was at a stage in my law professor career where I could devote time to the project, and so that's how it came about. But if I learned anything from writing this book, it is an even greater esteem than I already had for the work of all judges on this court at the trial and appellate levels. In the book, I express my gratitude and do so again today for the willing assistance and openness of many judges here on this court in speaking with me about this court's work. I think it is important for more books like this to be written about judges other than those who have served on the United States Supreme Court. This was a topic explored recently at the D.C. Circuit Judicial Conference in June. I was on a member of a panel discussing the topic, the preservation of judges' private papers for historical research in future years. And among other panelists, there was an archivist from the Library of Congress and so forth. I was there. I was part of the panel because of this recent book as an example of the uses to which some enterprising scholar might put the collections of private judicial papers that we were talking about. The basic idea was an easy sell to the judges of the D.C. Circuit. They envisioned their court to be a level of importance above the standard numbered circuit courts of appeal. And so it was very easy to convince them that someone in the future might be interested in looking at their judicial papers. Now, there was divided opinion expressed fairly strongly by the judges there that communications among judges in the course of deciding cases should be off limits to researchers, at least for some time period while those persons are still on the court. And an example, and this is something of an extreme example, but Justice David Souter, I believe, has made arrangements now for his papers to be released 50 years after his death. So So to the extent to which I made use of those communications involving judges who were still serving, even if it was a case from 20 years ago, for example, the view is, you know, that I should have, and tried to, in fact, in all of the instances that I'm aware of, sought permission from that particular judge whose communications might have appeared in Judge Arnold's papers. So it was not merely enough to have Richard Arnold's permission was the takeaway point there. So I have endeavored to do that in this book, and if there are mistakes of this nature, if I have referred to any sort of internal communications that that I neglected to get advance approval for, my apologies. As I thought to myself after I left the D.C. Circuit panel, the point of which, after all, was to encourage more judges to think about making their papers available in future years. As I was leaving that, I realized the truth of the quote, that if I could not be a good example, then I would just have to serve as a horrible warning. But I hope we were successful, at least, in making the point that understanding the work of the lower court judges is especially important. We have more information than we can digest about Supreme Court justices and the cases that make it there, but not for the daily operation of the federal courts and the great majority of cases in the federal system. But the point, again, is to emphasize that while Judge Richard Arnold was an outstanding judge, so are and were a lot of other judges who have served on this court. They are very hardworking public servants, together with the court staff in this family who've devoted large segments of their careers to the cause of justice. Because many people here knew Judge Arnold very well and for a much longer period than I did, I thought it might be of more interest to comment on some earlier periods of Richard Arnold's life rather than recounting highlights of his more recent judicial career. His educational attainments are now legendary. He was a classics scholar at Phillips Exeter Academy. It was the only time he would finish second in any academic endeavor. He went from there to Yale College, finishing first in his class at Yale College, and then first in his class at Harvard Law School. Becoming a federal judge was not the role he originally envisioned during those years. His ambition was to serve in the United States Senate from Arkansas. And his engagements in his school years, both at Phillips Exeter and Yale, along with Harvard, make it easy to see that some form of public engagement would follow. And he was seriously engaged in scholarship, particularly in Latin and Greek. One example. For his senior essay in classics at Yale, Richard Arnold wrote a 108-page paper titled "The Emperor Constantine and the Christian Church." It is a well-written, comprehensive study of academic theories that had been put forward to date to explain the reasons that led the Emperor Constantine to embrace the fledgling Christian church. Sources are quoted in that thesis in the original Greek, handwritten in footnotes, because they could not be typed, but handwritten in Arnold's sparse printing style. I want to read a very brief excerpt from Arnold's introduction to this thesis because I think it tells us a lot about his wisdom and his discernment about people, and it's evident already at the age of 21. In this thesis, Arnold specified that his historical interpretation was guided by the view, and here's where the quote begins, that all human actions are the result of mixed and ever-changing motives, sometimes unknown even to the person who takes those actions, and never derived from any single pure purpose. End of quote. As an evaluation of historical development, that statement too could be read as a larger philosophy, both about the art of politics and cautions in the job of judging others. All of these views expressed very pithily in a couple of sentences at the age of 21. Well, of course, a stellar career at Harvard Law School and a clerkship with Justice William Brennan followed. Richard Arnold would eventually return to Arkansas to practice law and to engage in politics. This included two unsuccessful races for Congress. He was probably not a natural campaigner, and it is hard for most people who only knew him as a federal judge to picture him in any other role. But his political engagements, even if not successful in the electoral arena, drew the attention of Arkansas governors, and particularly Governor and later Senator Dale Bumpers. And as many of you know, it was this connection that was one of the keys to Richard Arnold's appointment to the federal judiciary twice by President Jimmy Carter. And to the best of my knowledge, Richard Arnold is the only judge with that distinction, as far as I'm aware. Richard first served on the Federal District Court in Little Rock. I want to relate a brief story about Judge Arnold's investiture as a district court judge when he was officially sworn into office by Judge G. Thomas Eisley. The year is 1978. The Arkansas Attorney General at the time was a 32-year-old holding his first elected office, Bill Clinton. 10 years Arnold's junior, Clinton was elected as Attorney General in 1977, serving one term before running successfully for governor. Clinton was not originally on the program for Arnold's investiture. Arnold ran into Clinton a few days earlier on Capitol Avenue in Little Rock and asked Clinton if he would like to speak. Clinton explained to the audience why his name was not listed on the program, and he joked about being a last-minute addition. And Clinton said this at the investiture: "I feel that I have a right to be here because for nearly a decade, as long as I have been active in some capacity in Arkansas politics, people have been coming up to me with this kind of compliment. You know, you're almost as smart as Richard Arnold." Judge Gerald Haney also addressed the court that day. He had traveled to Little Rock on behalf of the Eighth Circuit to be at Richard Arnold's swearing-in ceremony. Judge Haney was very much aware that the Eastern District of Arkansas at that time faced the largest backlog of civil rights cases in the country. He pointed out that Richard Arnold's share of that pending caseload would be at least 400 civil and criminal cases. And Judge Haney said the following. He said, "The judges of this court have attempted under almost impossible circumstances to handle the pending caseload during the time that they have been without the judicial manpower they have needed. Perhaps with the new judiciary bill that has been passed," Haney said, "we will get some additional relief, which will enable this court to fulfill its historic function." Haney also looked forward to an additional judge for the Eighth Circuit that would be created by that judiciary bill as a result of the bill, and ironically, that judge would be Richard Arnold. So he served on the Eighth Circuit from that point forward, 1980 through 2004, for over 25 years of judicial service and nearly 25 on the Eighth Circuit itself. The book manuscript that I sent to the publisher was originally one-third longer than what you ultimately see in the book. Within 24 hours of receipt of my manuscript, the publisher sent me an email to say they were returning it because it was too long. As painful as that was at the time, I undertook to pare it down by the approximate number of words that I was requested to do, and I think that it was a good thing. I think the book has been improved by paring it down. What I'd like to share with you are a couple of the so-called outtakes, things that didn't make it into the book, and you may understand why they didn't make it into the book after I describe it to you. But it reminds me of another story from the summer of 2004, and again, this is before Richard Arnold's final illness, and I had the opportunity to speak with him about this project. He asked me what I thought the model for the book would be. Did I have something in mind? I was calling it a judicial biography. Did I have a particular kind of book in mind? And I said, well, you know, I haven't really thought about it, but maybe the model will be Gerald Gunther's biography of Judge Learned Hand. And some of you may be familiar with this. Judge Arnold seemed alarmed when I mentioned that to him. And he, in his quietly alarmed fashion, He noted that he thought Gunther's book was just enormously long and overly detailed. And he had never been able to get all the way through it. But that's all he ever said about it in terms of giving me some suggestions about how I might go about the project. But among some of the outtakes, if you will, or what didn't make it into the book, many related to his marvelous sense of humor, which many of you would be familiar with. That it was a sense of humor that was never at anyone else's expense. So there are some stories like that hit the cutting room floor. One of them that actually made it into the book, though, is not one that I was present at, but it was related to me by Brenda King and Becky Harris. Return trip to the airport from the courthouse in St. Paul. It was a Friday afternoon. It was going to be close whether the flight would be made. And as the rental car, which Judge Arnold is driving, comes to a railroad crossing, yes, there apparently was getting to the airport, it meant crossing some train tracks. As luck would have it, there was a very long train that was just beginning its way across the tracks. So the car is quiet with Judge Arnold there, the staff, law clerks along. And they waited and waited. It's an enormously long train. Well, just as that train got to the end, another train started in the other direction, and it was equally long. And Judge Arnold didn't say much except sort of looked around and said, well, at least that will take our minds off the first train. So there are many instances of humor that could have been added. So if anything, I don't know that the book adequately portrays that side of him. But you all know it was there. He also had, there were many episodes that I could have added but didn't, about his uncanny recall and brilliance. And anecdotes abound that you no doubt will recall, those of you who knew him. And one of my favorites involves seeing this happen more than once in chambers. A case would come to mind. He would ask his clerks, if we were discussing an upcoming oral argument, ask us whether a certain case had been mentioned by the parties or had been addressed by the parties. And we would usually look around confusedly and say no, or we don't think so. He would not only name the case, he would get up from his desk and walk over to his set of U.S. reports, and he would pull down the correct volume. Sometimes he had to look at the table of contents to get to the right page, but not always. And it was that sort of uncanny recall and brilliance, I think, that also people remember. One story that was cut, this is again an outtake, if you will, it might be enjoyable to hear about. This story involves the Little Rock Country Club and a formerly common rule, not just at the Little Rock Country Club, but at many private golf clubs, a formerly common rule that women could not golf on Saturday mornings. It was a widespread practice up until even a few years ago. There's a golf course very near where I work at Emory University, the Druid Hills Golf Course, that had the similar rule. The theory was, I think, that Saturdays should be reserved for men because they had to work during the week, had fewer opportunities. Typically, for the women members of these clubs, a weekday morning would be set aside for exclusively women's tea times. The other theory was that women played more slowly than men, so a men-only course time would result in faster play for everyone. Well, one evening, I think maybe it was over lunch, my cousin had joined us, and she told Judge Arnold a story that had happened to her the previous week. It was about a Saturday morning golf outing at the Little Rock Country Club with her husband and her father-in-law. The course marshal, they'd played three holes, I think. The course marshal drove out to the course and told her that she couldn't play and had to sit in the cart for the remainder of the round. And so she told this story to Judge Arnold. Well, Richard Arnold thought that was terrible, and he said so. He also arranged a few weeks later to take one of his daughters golfing there. On a Saturday morning, he wanted to test the rule, and I like to think of it as he was creating standing a test case there. No one said a word to him, of course. He is a federal judge. But I would imagine that he also had some private conversations with the membership, with a membership there. And then a few weeks later, he was still thinking about it because he happened to mention in passing, he said, "You know, I think it might be better if speed is the issue on a Saturday morning, that what we should do is use handicap rather than gender if the goal is to ration a scarce resource, i.e. the Saturday morning tea time." So, he'd been thinking about it all along. In any event, that's one of the stories that did not make it into the book, but the book is probably better for the numerous cuts that needed to be made. Well, there's much more that could be said. Arnold was a particularly open judge. He believed that courts should be both open and understandable to the general public. He thought that continued acceptance and the power of the federal judiciary depended on less secretive work when possible. And in particular, that would bring to mind for you, of course, his views about unpublished opinions as an example. His Anastasov opinion set off a national debate. And Tony Morrow of the Legal Times wrote that Richard Arnold's views were vindicated in 2006 with the Supreme Court's rule change for all federal appellate courts to allow citation to unpublished opinions. I think maybe what I would like to do is open it up for your questions and comments, and you may have stories as well, rather than continuing to hear from me. But I did want to conclude with this. It's a reading from the Eighth Circuit's resolution that was presented at a memorial session in January 2005 in this courthouse. And here's what that resolution wrote, and some of you here probably had a hand in writing this. "He was at his best in expounding constitutional rights, particularly as they protect the less fortunate in our society. His contribution to the development of the law in this circuit alone, as well as its impact on the work of the Supreme Court, place him among the very few most significant judges to serve not only on this court, but all the courts of the nation." So this, in conclusion, this notion of serving together on all the courts of the nation was very significant to Richard Arnold. He took great pride in the institution and its judges, even as he continually worked to improve it. So I would be delighted to take questions or comments if you have any. We have a few more minutes before the reception begins. I'm a law professor. I will call on you if we do not get. Yeah. It is his interest in religion is really a lifelong interest, as I discovered in doing some of the research for the book. So you see that he is devout in his Protestant Episcopal faith in the college years, through law school, and so forth. So it's not something that really varied greatly over his life. I do think that he was attracted both as a spiritual matter and as an intellectual matter in terms of theology. And so he was very engaged in and interested in differences between the Catholic Church and the Episcopal Church, and it explored ways to combine his interests in those faiths. He also was part of a study group that worked out of the St. Louis Abbey that included texts of Jewish rabbinical texts, Catholic texts, and others. So it is fascinating to see that. I think that he also was not one to he wouldn't advertise his spiritual journey or his spirituality, but as his friends would know, if you asked him about it, he would tell you. But it was not something that was evident in his public life. Yes. Judge, that's a great story, and it's I address this to some extent in the book, to talk about the Jaycees case. It was one of, I believe that was one of the three cases. It would be very rare for Richard Arnold opinion to be reversed by the Supreme Court, but that unlucky summer there were three. And the combined votes, as Arnold would note, was something like, I don't know if you have the numbers off the top of your head, but 26-0, something like that. Yeah, and as he would say, nobody can be that wrong. but I think that's right. You know, he talked a little bit about that with I did some interviews with him before his final illness, and he would talk about that case, and he said that, you know, he really thought he was following precedent, and that he really thought that the better part, it was a close case, but the better part of the case was in favor of the First Amendment. But I think you're right that that some people may have taken that without reading thoroughly into the case or looking at his opinions, might have taken that as some kind of ammunition that he was against women or against women's rights, and nothing could really be further from the truth than that, but it was an interesting decision. Yes. Well, these are all wonderful memories to share, and if I'm lucky enough to get a second edition of the book, maybe I can put some of those in as well as some of the stories that hit the cutting room floor. Yes, Michael. Thank you all again for being here, and I'll look forward to have a chance to speak with you outside.